Reflective network therapy is literally an application of child analysis in the real life setting of a preschool.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Hello, welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Gilbert Kleiman. Dr. Kleiman is a child and adult psychoanalyst, and he's an unusual analyst for a number of reasons. Most importantly, for our purposes, is that he has focused his career on providing outcome measures for his clinical work. And those outcome measures, as we're about to discuss today, are truly remarkable. Before we get to that, a bit about his credentials. He has a Distinguished Life Fellow status in the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the American Psychoanalytic Association. He's a graduate of the Interdisciplinary Fellowship in Science and Psychiatry at Albert Einstein Medical College in New York. He is a recipient of the American Psychoanalytic Association's 2020 Humanitarian Award, the Anna Freud Award for Childhood Research in 2016, the Dean Brockman Award in 2014, and the French Psychoanalytic Society Award in 2014. I trust you're beginning to get the picture that this is a man who has really contributed in a major way to the field of child analysis, child therapy, and most centrally to the well-being of the people whose lives he touches. He has, and we'll talk about this today, discovered and created a new method of intervening in children's lives called reflective network therapy. And we're going to discuss this in detail, because it is that treatment approach that has led to the major finding that we're going to open our conversation with today. I hope you find it as important as I do. Gilbert, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Harvey.
You know, Gilbert, it isn't usual on this podcast for me to have the opportunity to share important research findings from the world of mental health treatment. But today I do, and rather than I share this information with our audience, I'd like to invite you to, as you are the creator of the program that's responsible for these important findings.
Well, I'm very glad that you regard them as important, Harvey. I think it is important that something outside of the usual clinical findings of analysis, including child analysis, is now evidence-based. And that is, there are very good cognitive effects of applying child analysis within the real-life space of preschools, especially for special needs children who have been traumatized or who have developmental disorders. So I'm pleased to report to you that we now have 81 children treated by an applied psychoanalytic method who have remarkable IQ rises compared to their baseline condition, and that amongst 63 control and comparison children, there are no such IQ rises. So having studied 143 children amongst the data sets and 9 projects in various locations on 2 continents, we find that the phenomenon of IQ rise is robust, sturdy, highly significant, very unlikely to be due to chance. Further, we're finding that in long-term follow-ups, there is good effect, so that we can point to children whose IQ kept rising and who have some remarkable achievements, having started out with very ordinary or even intellectually disabled levels of cognition.
This is a remarkable finding. And can you tell us what's responsible for it? What the treatment program that you've shared with these kids has been that has led to this major change in their lives?
The treatment program is called reflective network therapy. Reflective network therapy is an application of child analysis in a way that is manualized. I've manualized it in Kleiman 2011, a book called Reflective Network Therapy in the Preschool Setting. Reflective network therapy is literally an application of child analysis in the real life setting of a preschool. Its focus is usually on a disturbed child or a child who has developmental difficulties such as autism. The child who is usually one of 3, 4, or even 12 patients within a regular or special preschool is focused upon by a child analyst for about 20 minutes at a time, 4 or 5 days a week.
This is in the classroom?
Right in the classroom and only in the classroom. The child analyst does everything that a child analyst can do with a child called the index patient in this method. And for 20 minutes, that child is receiving a kind of play therapy, often with interpretations, often manifesting transference aspects of treatment that can be interpreted. That's not so special. What is very special is that a network is established within the classroom so that the teacher and other children are very much aware of the analytic session. There are procedures which must be followed in order to set this in motion. First, the teacher has to brief the analyst before the session starts. That briefing only takes a couple of minutes, but the teacher has to think and explain to the analyst and the child what the child has been doing early that morning before the analyst came in. And often the teacher is in contact with the family of the child and has news, which the teacher imparts to the analyst verbally as the child and others in the classroom listen. There is no privacy in this matter. There is a deliberate creation of a knowledgeable network which knows and supports the mental life of the child.
That's a key variable in this that really marks it as unique. Again, to emphasize, there's no privacy in this. So these conversations between the teacher, the analyst, and the index patient are taking place in the classroom within earshot of other students. Do I have that right?
That's correct. And the play session between the analyst and the child is also not private. It takes place within a classroom, and other children are likely to not only hear it, but they may be invited by the index patient to participate in a game or a drama or a story or a building activity or painting or artistic activity, which is chosen by and controlled by the index patient for those 20 minutes.
You know, I have to tell you my reaction to this, it might be similar to others. Had I not known that we have real data that shows how powerful and useful what you just described is, my reaction would be that it's a disservice, that it's a disservice to the child that he is being deprived of the special intimacy and privacy that individual treatment has as its core. That's my gut reaction. And yet, what you do works. And that obviously has to take priority over any prejudice that I bring to it.
Yes, I haven't really finished describing the method, but I'll tell you how I discovered it and how I overcame the same kinds of concerns you have. After the play session between the analyst and the index child, there's what's called a debriefing, in which the child and the analyst try to explain to the teacher and anyone else in the classroom who's interested, usually other children, try to explain what they've been doing. For example, the analyst may say, Jay tried to show me how lobsters pinch at the beach, and he was very worried that the lobster might pinch his body, and he told me things that scared him about pinching lobsters. And, you know, pinching is a very important thing for Jay. Other children hear that and might say, oh, yes. In fact, another child might say, well, Jay pinched me yesterday. The teacher also hears this. After the debriefing, the analyst goes on to work with another child. There's usually a schedule, so there are kinds of appointments. Each child is seen each day, if possible. This occurs, as you can see, about 40 weeks a year, a usual school year with summer vacations. And if it occurs four times a week, it's 160 brief analytic sessions, 160 briefings, 160 debriefings. In addition, each parent is seen each week for about 45 minutes in private by the teacher or the therapist. Most of the sessions are done by teachers, and at least once a month, the child analyst gets together with the parent. And again, there is a briefing and debriefing process in which information is shared from the family to the therapeutic team and from the team to the family via a parent.
Is the teacher trained to do this?
Yes. There is a training period, and it usually doesn't take very long. In fact, teachers are quite a bit more experienced in my finding than child analysts are in dealing with parents. So I'm pleased that most of the work with the parents is done by teachers, and I notice that parents find that highly acceptable, and they're used to dealing with teachers and find it not stigmatizing, not very special. Well, I shared your view about privacy until I set up a therapeutic preschool in 1965. And because it was my baby, in a sense, I used to visit the preschool quite often. And I found in that setting that the patients wanted to talk with me. And they talked with me about the kinds of things that a child analytic patient would ordinarily talk with me about. They seemed to be glad to have the opportunity. And I began to describe to Marianne Criss, who was then my child analytic supervisor, that I thought my contacts with the children in the therapeutic preschool were not very different from my experience in classical child analysis. She was quite interested and encouraged me to keep records about it, and she volunteered to supervise me in this process and did so for a couple of years every week, a very generous contribution on her part. And we were well satisfied that the process was deep, complex, and clinically very helpful. I didn't know about the cognitive effects at first. The way I discovered them was that in my first publication in the Psychoanalytic Study of the Child, the editor was Anna Freud, as well as Lottie Newman. Now, Anna Freud expressed to Lottie, who told me, that Anna Freud was pleased with the paper, thought it was important, but she was very dubious about the quotations of the child, whose code name is Jay in that case, in the 1980 volume of Psychoanalytic Study of the Child. She said she was pretty sure that the language was adult language, not child language.
This is the patient whose cognitive improvement you noted and started you thinking along these lines?
Well, it started me thinking that if Anna Freud was skeptical, I was embarrassed. And I shared this with the grandfather of the child, who occasionally came as a collateral. And he donated a large mobile video camera to the school. We began studying the videotapes then. And we were pretty well convinced that the quotations mm-hmm. were accurate. And I then invited psychologists to do third-party evaluations of the children cognitively as well as clinically. It soon became evident that there were big IQ jumps. For example, if you look at the website of the Children's Psychological Health Center.org.
Which we will include in the liner notes of the podcast.
Right. You'll see there's a 33-year follow-up of a child who was in that early vintage of the therapeutic preschool. She was mute, very withdrawn. She had lost her 100-word vocabulary at age 2.5, almost 3. She had been well-functioning, toilet-trained, fluent, and sociable. Then she withdrew into an autistic state, whirling, twirling, flapping, standing in corners and not speaking. After about 2.5 years, we were able to test her cognitively. She had an 80 IQ. But ultimately, at age 12, she had 120 IQ and then 149 IQ after that. She speaks in a 33-year follow-up video on our website. She uses her own name, which is Dorian. And I well remember the transference and countertransference in this extraordinarily encouraging experience that she started to emerge as an interesting, extremely withdrawn and very skittish, anxious, avoidant person, but she became ultimately quite interested in other children, in their anatomies, how they urinated, and she would play with animals, insects, I should say, in the backyard and try to cook them and make them into soups. Then she emerged into an Oedipal interest and wanted to marry me, which I thought was commendable and interpretable on her part. I noticed in the 33-year follow-up, she's slightly flirtatious with me. She has by now raised two children, is a writer of reviews of movies and books, and has a busy marital life, a very rich individual, emotionally speaking. Unlike her psychotic sister, and who's been institutionalized, and unlike a number of people in her family who appear to have been autistic in prior generations.
Is there something in particular from the treatment that you were involved with her that you would look back and see as essential to her remarkable development?
Yes, and I think she has a theory about it also, which is the same as my theory. And that is, we treated her with great care and tenderness so that a number of us felt affection for her in the classroom. And we were very cautious in approaching her as if she might be distressed by our proximity. We didn't get in her face. We were respectful of her avoidance until she came out of it and wanted to have a relationship. At some points, I would speak to her and say, "Dorian, I know you are in there." And she responded to that knowledge on my part. I felt that the previous developmental levels she had achieved, although they were functionally lost, were still available to her to some extent if she could be coaxed out of the defense of extreme avoidance. Later on, I was to develop a theory of autism as a form of congenital trauma aversion in which ordinary life is perceived as traumatic and ordinary relationships, touches, and eye contact are extremely distressing to the autistic newborn and child. And this, I think, has guided me and others to effectively treat quite a few autistic children with this method. We now have permitted videos of some. I just saw a video of a child I treated in a regular preschool in Santa Rosa, whose mother and I discussed the fact that the child, who was generally very withdrawn, seemed to want to sit on my lap. And I got the mother's permission to let that happen, telling the child that I could see he wanted to sit on my lap. When I permitted that, he started to point at objects in the distance and share his gaze with me, naming objects and people in the distance in a way he had never done before, indicating an emergence from the avoidant defense mm-hmm. of autism. And during a one-year period, we were able to document a 30-point rise in his IQ. He's now 4 years older and is skiing, sociable, verbally fluent, and doing pretty well in school. So that was another use of the hypothesis that...
Let me ask you a question about that. What you're describing, as I'm hearing you, is really attuned and elegant child analytic work. How is that reflective network therapy?
Well, it is happening as tuned analytic work within a classroom, within a network.
Okay.
If you see that boy and videos, you see he's very involved with the other children.
I see.
He treats them like brothers and sisters. He has tantrums in front of them. He's angry and distraught in front of them and with teachers. They become a therapeutic family in which we reflect upon his distresses.
Do you have any information about the impact of this remarkable work on those who are observing it, the rest of the classroom?
Well, we think that teachers become very elegant observers. And the analysts, there are 27 now who've carried this out. The analysts, I think, become far better child analysts than they ever were before. The other children often are neurotypical children, sometimes in large numbers. For example, in Santa Rosa, there were 40 children in that classroom where I described one of the index patients becoming emerging, rather, from his autistic state, along with several other non-autistic index patients. The other 40 children become remarkably altruistic. So they tend to reach out to the patients. Sometimes they're jealous and would like to have some time for themselves. Sure. With the analyst, but that's constructive jealousy, and sometimes leads to them becoming appropriate patients. A few have persuaded their parents and allowed us to persuade their parents, yes, that child does have difficulties which could be helped analytically. The altruism, I think, is a big part of it. And there, we don't think that we know much about the cognitive outcomes with the observing children, but it looks good. We do have some excellent controls. For example, in San Mateo, we had a therapeutic preschool in a special education class, and there was a comparison, actually a control untreated class, in another part of a very similar nature, socioeconomically and ethnically, in another part of the county, where no RNT was given, just the regular special education for the special needs preschoolers. Those 10 controls had no rise of IQ. They had actually had a slight decline.
Wow.
Our children in RNT, as evaluated by a doctoral student, third party, not a therapist, had very substantial rises. And they had very good long-term consequences, some of which we know about and are surprised about, very pleasantly surprised, how the cognitive advances and social advances keep growing as if there is either a release of development or a self-analytic process. We don't know much about that, but I'm inclined to think, as Anna Freud did, that one of the functions of child analysis is to unhitch an arrest of development. And once that's unhitched, it keeps on going, unlike perhaps adult psychoanalysis, which doesn't have that developmental advantage.
So sometimes when you free up neurotic conflict in adults, they grow and blossom in many other areas as well. But I have to share with you my reaction in listening to you. You know, often when you hear stories of military adventures and someone does something unexpected and heroic, you ask yourself the question, well, would I have done that under those circumstances? And as I listen to you face the question of privacy, that's what's organizing my thinking.
Yes.
It seems so foundational to me that if I looked at data that showed me that giving up privacy still produced important, or especially produced important changes in growth in the index patient, I would have trouble myself still going with it and building a theory around it. So I say that in admiration, because I think you've done something revolutionary, being guided by I don't know what, and perhaps maybe this is a good time for me to ask you about yourself. Tell me about you and what leads you to this work and give you the play in your mind to work outside our usual frameworks.
Well, I think I am an unusually adventurous person. And that is because I had to survive, or chose unwittingly to survive, by being counterphobic. So I came from a Holocaust and pogrom-ridden family, and a family ridden by many deaths of a genetic origin, which I share, an often fatal syndrome called the Lynch, Lynch syndrome. My family was very worried about me as the first child in my generation and the only child of my parents, and the first grandchild of survivors of tremendous tragedies. They tried to restrain my adventurousness. I remember their worries as I went about the neighborhood on a tricycle. I had to blow a whistle to make them sure I was okay. So ultimately, I broke away from those constraints. I think I did the same thing in my research. I was an interdisciplinary fellow at Einstein, and very interested in psychoanalysis from a very early age. I thought of many ways to test psychoanalytic hypotheses, and did so with constraints, essentially from a psychoanalytic institute which was very anxious. Classical New York Psychoanalytic Institute, which I remember got rid of one of my classmates because he was interested in psychopharmacology, and he was thought to be an alien for that reason. But with the encouragement of Mort Reiser, who was head of the Interdisciplinary Science and Psychiatry Fellowship, he encouraged me to set up my own shop because I had so many research ideas. Then, with Marianne Criss, like a good mother and a fearless one, I think I took off. I also was becoming a pilot, a very skilled airplane and glider pilot. And I felt different from other analysts, less constrained, more involved in testing things like perceptual defenses under hypnotic states, and then realizing that I had views about childhood traumas which were different from classical views. I thought, for example, that children did mourn, and that was the basis for my setting up a therapeutic preschool, because the head of the Albert Einstein Bronx Municipal Hospital Department of Psychiatry didn't think we should use city funds for preventive purposes with bereaved children, which was a very important focus for me. So when I set up the preschool, I found that children who were bereaved actually were more amenable to analytic approaches rather than less amenable, even though Anna Freud had cautioned it's a bad time to do analysis if someone is bereaved. I thought she was completely wrong. And I think to this day, I think she was completely wrong. And I think the field has caught up with my adventurous applications of child analysis to bereaved children. This is separate, of course, from studying the cognitive aspects. It is not congenial to most psychoanalysts to do hard measures. I once got a grant for the Alliance for Psychoanalytic Preschools. I remember my aunt gave me $5,000 to do with as I pleased, and I gave it to the Alliance for Psychoanalytic Preschools for the purpose of them acquiring IQ tests of their children, because I felt the phenomenon I was observing might be widespread in therapeutic and analytically oriented preschools. They lost the money. They've never been able to account for it. And it seems to me that the disappearance of that grant reflects a psychoanalytic attitude towards research, which is very pervasive and requires an adventurous spirit to overcome. It was, in fact, an engineer who consulted with me about research in child analysis, who finally did one of the most important experiments in psychoanalysis. That's Edward Jeffery, who in 2001 in the Psychoanalytic Quarterly reported on his study of mortality among psychoanalysts and confirmed my hunch that psychoanalysts, despite being sedentary, live longer than controlled cohorts of psychiatrists from same ethnic and socioeconomic groups.
And you have reason to think, if I understand this right, that that applies both to analysts and analysands. Do I have that right?
I would think so, but I only know about analysts, and I think that's all analysts have hopefully been analyzed more thoroughly than the average analyst. And but be that as it may, you see, it took an engineer to do that study. And I think it took me to insist that there are measures outside of clinical that had to be studied. And I well remember at the Orthopsychiatry Convention in San Francisco in 1986 or so, I encountered a woman who said to me, you're Dr. Kleiman. I thought you were dead. I've been carrying out your method in 17 preschools in the state of Oklahoma for the past 10 years, and the results are just amazing. But I didn't know you were still around. And I said, well, why did you think I was dead? Well, she said, you published in the Psychoanalytic Study of the Child, and I thought, naturally, you're dead. So that taught me something about the scientific standing of psychoanalysis and the lack of liveliness. So it's very lively to work in a preschool, and it's very non-standard, and one has to be accustomed to psychology outside the dyad. Furthermore, I have to be extremely modern to think in informational terms. I'm pretty well convinced now that reflective network therapy, as I've described it, involves much more than a relationship to the index child. I think it involves a relationship to a field of information, which the network creates with the help of the child, the parent, the teachers, the peers, that all that extremely complex and rich information focused upon the child is the arena which the analyst is using. It's the data the analyst is using to make analytic interventions. But they are not linear. They are much more complex than the dyadic and more linear interpretations and relations that go on in classical analytic work. And so it may be that it is the very richness, complexity, and similarity probably to the evolutionary status of children in our species, how they evolved in small networks, not in dyads. They learned to learn in small networks, not in dyads. That this probably accounts for the cognitive effects, at least in part.
Gilbert, you've written about your legacy, and listening to you and hearing your gusto and the breadth of your interests and the creativity with which you approach these interests and your openness to new ideas, that is your legacy. It's not the content of what you discover, however important that is, but the legacy that I take from our spending this time together is the openness, and something you wrote in one of your papers, that you find a joy in going beyond the boundaries of office practice. And that joy is palpable, it's communicable, and hopefully everyone listening to this will share in your joy and will visit the websites listed below and will read your papers and will catch a little bit of your enthusiasm for life and your enthusiasm for giving life to other people, as you've been able to do over these many, many decades. I thank you. I thank you for agreeing to do this. I thank you for sharing this love you have of this work with me and with our listeners, and for your continuing to do this good work.
Thank you so much, Harvey, for eliciting all my enthusiasm. I would love to tell you more. You are so appreciative, and you are appreciated by me.
Thanks so much. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.